Hey folks, Sam Jones here. I feel like we should have some trumpet playing. Okay. And that's Nathan Shields, our multi-talented sound man, cameraman, editor, and trumpet player, helping me out with a little bit of fanfare because this is the 100th episode of Off Camera. What's Off Camera? Well, as you know, it's the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this very special episode, I sit down with director, actor, and producer Ron Howard. You know, when we started this thing, I never thought it would go 100 episodes, and we're planning on making a ton more. But Ron Howard reached his 100th episode when he was just 10 years old on The Andy Griffith Show. But his big dream was to direct a feature by the time he was 19. He didn't reach that goal until he was 23, but let's give him a break. He was busy acting in some of the most popular television shows of their time, including the aforementioned Andy Griffith Show and Happy Days. Ron knows he was lucky to have the parents and early opportunities that he did. He also never took them for granted or missed an opportunity to learn from them. He negotiated his way into his first directing job and has been proving himself as one of our most talented and deeply human storytellers ever since. As widely as his subjects range, space, mermaids, race cars, parenthood, schizophrenia, and now Einstein, they have one common element: Ron's ability to let us know exactly how it feels to inhabit those worlds. Despite appearances, success hasn't always come easy, largely because Ron sets such a high bar for himself. In this conversation, he talks about his transition from acting to directing, working with some of our best-known actors, and why the editing room used to want to make him slit his wrists. He also shares how a 17-hour, vomit-soaked plane ride led to the most important and personal film of his career. We'd probably need 100 more episodes to truly cover his story, but I wasn't going to miss the chance to sit down with an artist and human who personifies so many of the qualities we celebrate on this show. So pull up a chair and listen in. Okay, Nate, you can do the trumpet. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's good to see you, Sam.
You know, obviously, kids in this day and age with the golden age of television and opportunity and every show ever made at their fingertips, I don't think can quite understand how limited our television choices were.
Right.
As children.
Hey, oh, man.
Me as a kid growing up, there was really The Brady Bunch, The Partridge Family, Happy Days, Andy Griffith, maybe The $6 Million Man. And that's what television was like back then. So I feel like I grew up knowing you.
Well.
And then I'm a fan of the films you've done.
Thank you.
And this is a big occasion for me to have you on the show because it's our 100th episode.
100th?
Yes.
That's an honor.
It's an honor. 100th.
Hey, 100 is a hard number to get to in any era. It's a congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I've been involved in a few TV shows that made it to 100.
A few?
I guess the first time I was involved in a 100th episode, if I'm doing the math here, we started off doing 39 Andy Griffith shows. Then we did 32, which was a bit of a break. So probably, I guess, around age 10.
Age 10.
Around 10, age 10.
Well,
I don't want to minimize, this moment.
I have been called a late bloomer. But I think it's fair to say that you are an early bloomer.
Well, I had some great opportunities, and I really did. And the greatest opportunity of all are with the parents that I was born to,
you know.
And my father, Rance Howard, who is still with us, still working.
Yeah.
He's up in Marin County right now shooting a TV show. Was a natural born, kind of a genius of a father, and also a fantastic acting teacher and he was already an actor, but he knew how to impart.
Well, you know, I looked at his IMDb page, and he has 9 projects in development. I mean, he's 88 years old, correct?
Yes, he's 88.
And he seems like he has more things going on than almost anybody.
He's a busy man. He's very competitive, and every once in a while, I remember growing up, I'd say, "How was that audition, Dad?" And he said, he'd mention somebody and say, "Oh, that son of a bitch got the part. He always gets the part." And then I'd mention another one, and there'd be somebody else. And he'd say, "Oh, yeah, they gave it to Simon. That son of a bitch always beats me out." And he's just been working so much of late. And I said, "Well, Dad, you're working a lot. I guess I guess you've outlived some of those other sons of bitches, huh? And he said, yeah, but not enough of them yet. So the fire is still there in the belly.
Do you think there's something to the idea that you guys are hard workers in your genes? Because you look at your IMDb page and you have film credits in 7 decades.
Well, I got an early start, you know.
You certainly did.
And I've enjoyed it. And, you know, I think one of the things that I was a huge benefit was that I always enjoyed it. So I didn't go through a period of...
You never wanted to leave it and try something else.
I'm uncomfortable, I don't want to do this. I kind of knew what my default careers would be if I couldn't transition out of being a child actor and actually, you know, fulfill the dream that I had, which was to be a director.
What was your default career?
Well, it was either to be a history teacher, and probably try to be a basketball coach or something, you know, like a high school history teacher and basketball coach, or maybe to be a journalist. And
really?
At that time, I would have focused on sports journalism, probably. But I loved journalism all through school and was co-editor of the paper and things like that. So I've always been fascinated by that. And again, it gets back to parenting, but that work ethic is something that I could witness. Even though I was very quickly, early in my life, actually getting, you know, higher profile work than he was.
Right.
He handled that so incredibly well. And I think I also gained another understanding or a measure of gratitude because I could actually see how fortunate I was to be getting these kinds of roles. And it's a thing that so many other people are striving to gain. And I just have never taken that for granted. I don't to this day. I get excited when I show up on the set, even if I know it's going to be a tough day of shooting, and a part of me is like dreading some of the things I'm going to have to face, whether they're logistical or personality clashes or just struggles I might have creatively with the scene. I still, as the car is pulling up, I get a kind of surge of, all right, let's see what we can do. We have these resources, we have these people, we have this story, we have this opportunity. What can we do?
You're right, it's all parenting because, I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of confidence to make decisions at such an early age that set your life on course. I mean, you found your spouse and got married so young, had kids so young,
yeah.
Quit acting so young.
Well, I was getting a lot of reinforcement as an actor, But I could also see my own limitations, and so I have a pretty healthy dose of self-criticism that's always running along in the back of my mind. And I felt like, even though Happy Days was continuing to go along and be very successful and very lucrative, that I had to check myself, and I was beginning to direct during the off-seasons and loving it. But I also saw that the studio system, feature films, not going to embrace me while I was on a television series. They just wouldn't. And I became concerned that if I held off and went the full run of Happy Days, whatever that might be, that I might miss this moment.
Right.
And, you know, I guessed right, even though it was a tough decision and hard to leave everybody on that show and hard to leave the money. It was you know, I mean, it was great on a lot of levels. But, you know, I had been kind of deferring the dream of becoming a full-time director the entire time I was with the show.
Now put that in context with age. Well, deferring the dream. How old
I know,
were you?
Well, my first dream was to direct a feature while I was still in my teens. So that was the goal, kind of on a very superficial one. Who cares? But it mattered a little bit to me. But I didn't do that. I was at USC, and you know, I thought I might make an independent movie somehow, scrape it together. To you know, the independent market wasn't what it was today.
Right.
It was an even kookier idea. But when, to be honest, when I was 17, a senior in high school, my draft number for Viet was 41, and that was a low number. And there were no more college deferrals. There were no more educational deferrals. There were some work deferrals, and I had this opportunity to do a pilot for a TV show, even though I had just been accepted to USC film school, and that was what I wanted to do.
This was pre-Happy Days.
It was the Happy Days pilot that turned out to be on a spinoff of Love American Style and didn't sell. But I thought, I'll bet that ABC would keep me out of the jungle. if I was the lead of their sitcom. I didn't think it through any more than that, but it was sort of like that tipped the scales to a yes. So then the show didn't sell.
Right.
And then it came back 2 years later, and oddly, even though I'd gotten into USC, I realized that I hadn't quite given up the itch for acting. American Graffiti had been a big success, but I did a lot of acting jobs, movies, some good television movies and things like that, but not great stuff. And when Happy Days came along, I thought, you know, this is a pretty good gig, and I should take it. And I thought, TV shows, how many of them ever run? I'll bank a year or two.
It'll
go back
canceled.
To film school.
Yeah, right.
And it just kept going and going and going.
So you deferred your dream for a draft deferment.
which I didn't need because Nixon ultimately did away with the draft.
Right.
But I didn't agree with that war and I didn't want to go in and serve.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine in that age, you say you want to direct films and the response isn't what it would be today.
No. I got a lot of very patronizing pats on the head.
You did.
And directors saying, yeah, you keep it up when you get into your 30s, keep making short films and things. You know, the system was so different at that time. So the one place a new young filmmaker could have a chance to not have to scrape the money together, on their own, was working for Roger Corman.
The B-movie king.
Yeah. Again, there was no MTV at this point. There was no way to go do videos. He gave Martin Scorsese the first job. He gave Francis Coppola, Dementia 13, his first movie opportunity. Peter Bogdanovich, and it went on and on. Jonathan Demme. You know, lots and lots of award winners. Right after me was James Cameron. Then the list goes on and on. And he described his approach in a very interesting way. He said, it's up to the director to bring the point of view and even the politics. I don't care, but I need a genre that is fulfilled to the extent that an audience sees a poster, watches a trailer, goes to that movie and isn't disappointed on an escapism level.
So when you went and did that, I mean, you acted in the film. You did Grand Theft Auto, and you acted in it and directed it.
Well, before that, Happy Days had become a number one show in our third season. And I wasn't getting great movie offers as an actor. But this offer came in for a movie called Eat My Dust. And I read it, and it was kind of a goofy car chase comedy. And, I wasn't that impressed with it. But I had written a script with my father, which was like an indie-style movie, something I hoped to make kind of on my own in 16 or something. And when this came to me, I thought, this is an opportunity maybe. And I went to the meeting with Roger, and I even asked my agent of many years, the guy who'd been my agent as a kid, not to go to the meeting because I knew he wouldn't support what I was going to pitch. But I went into Roger, and I said, to be honest, I don't really love Eat My Dust, but I should have been wearing the T-shirt. What I really want to do is direct.
Yeah.
And I said, I know your reputation, and I'd like to follow in that path. I'd like to go to the University of Roger Corman, And he said, yes, we like to think we churn out directors for Hollywood the way USC churns out running backs for the NFL. That was his statement. And he said, well, let me read your script. And he read it, and he said, well, this is sort of an art film, and that's not really what I do. It's well written. He looked at a couple of short films that I'd made. They were very rough around the edges, but he said, I can really see that you can stage scenes and cut them together and all of that. So he said, here's what I'll do. I'm not going to promise you everything you want, but given what I can see in here, if you'll star and Eat My Dust, I will give you an opportunity to develop a story. And it can be you and your father or however you want to do it. And if that works, we'll go to screenplay. And if that works and I want to make it, you'll get to direct it, providing you star in it. And he said, if all that fails, I will guarantee you that you can direct the second unit on one of my other car crash movies. So hardly, it wasn't like I'd been, touched by the pellicula of the god of cinema with the golden opportunity, but it was concrete.
Yeah.
It was real, and I believed in Roger, and I thought, this is as, you know, this is somebody who's listening to my ambition. And so I did it. It was a hit. We went in, I went in and pitched a lot of ideas for kind of cool indie style movies I thought I'd want to make, a cool sci-fi thing, and a noir kind of movie, and I had a lot of ideas. And he said, well, those were all great, but he said, when we were testing titles for Eat My Dust, there was another title that came in a very close second, Grand Theft Auto. Roger's a very erudite man. Grand Theft Auto. If you can fashion a car crash comedy, starring yourself, of course, that we can correctly entitle Grand Theft Auto, that's a picture I might make.
Really? Based on the title?
In about 36 hours, my dad and I had an outline. In about another 3 weeks, we had a script. It was the fastest green light I think I've ever gotten in my life.
No kidding.
And I got to make Grand Theft Auto. And it led to a lot of great things. Not only a fantastic experience, hell of a learning experience. I mean, I was skinny going in. I lost 15 pounds making that movie.
Did you really?
I mean, I was really skin and bones when it was over. The editor, who was Joe Dante, the great director, was my editor. He was another Roger Corman graduate. And he called me up about halfway through. He said, Ron, you got to eat something. I know you're directing and you're starring, but you got to eat something. It's showing. It's showing in the dailies. It was a tremendous experience. And most important of all, and I was already married. I was 23 at this time. So I didn't make a movie at 19, but I did get to make it at 23.
Right.
And my wife Cheryl was a PA and everything. And then the crew was rebelling, and she wound up cooking the meals for everybody, and they loved her for it. And we got through the whole thing. And our wrap party was this impromptu gathering right next to the Saugus Speedway, where we'd finished shooting this car demolition derby sequence on our last day. The second unit was there. The first unit was there. We were all there, filthy. And it was just impromptu, doing shots, listening to whatever the bar band was, and dancing. And I remember saying to Cheryl, I said, I like this even more than I dreamed I would, you know? And so I was completely hooked.
Well, you say that the crew rebelled and you're young. I mean, I remember myself in my 20s and trying to go out there and make something of myself. I had days when I had a ton of confidence, and I had days when, if you blew on me, I'd shrivel up out of fear.
I thought I was going to get shit canned on the very first day.
Did you really?
Well, because I went in and I was nervous as hell, and I had to be in the scene, you know. And Roger had said, look, I have some requirements. You have to shot list everything, and I want you to diagram all the action scenes. So I had done all of that homework, and I was prepared, and I'd gone over and over it. Our cinematographer, Gary Graver, was an experienced guy, and yet Roger had said, I'm going to come the first day, probably just half the day. And he said, if it's going well, you won't see very much of me. But if it's not going well, and you're not making your days, you're going to see one hell of a lot of me. So I understood the rules, and I talked to Jonathan Demme and others who were already graduates, but who'd counseled me a little bit. And I knew that the budget was the thing, and I was just dying. I mean, by lunch, I think I was supposed to do 32 setups that day, and I think I'd done five or six or something, you know. And it was an interior scene with some lighting and some staging, and I was really sick. And Gary Graver came into my trailer and said, well, I think here's some ideas. We can simplify some things. And we wound up, you know, making our day. We went like 1 hour over and we made our day. It was brilliant. He really carried me. And Roger stayed all day, which was not what he was supposed to do. But he was very happy when it was over. And he came a little part of the second day and then he left. And he said, I think you're doing great, Ron. And the support was there. And by day three, I felt like I really had my rhythm, and I felt like I'd been directing for years, because I began to see that you could really trust the crew, because I did have a plan, but you didn't have to be rigid about it. You know, there were ways to be more expedient,
right?
And if you communicated more efficiently, you know, you got what was in your head, you know, onto the screen in a more consistent way. I just learned a hell of a lot very quickly. But having been an actor, I innately just understood the rhythm of a shooting day and that kind of creative problem solving. And it's why I always believe that the shortest cut to being like an effective, efficient director is having acted. It doesn't mean that you can't come out of film school having made a great short or be a fantastic DP and make a movie that no one ever will ever forget. But in terms of just, you know, having that skill set, that sensitivity to, with a live action production, getting that work done and realizing the, you know, the potential, the possibility of the of scenes, I think actors have a leg up.
I wonder how much your style was developed on that first film.
The biggest thing that I learned in that first film and in others were to really learn to not just trust collaboration, but to love it. And it took me a little while as a young director to be willing to say to a cinematographer or an actor or a writer, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I imagine. I mean, if you're the youngest guy on set, you already, I'm sure in your mind, you're already going, these guys are planning on me failing.
Yeah.
Or they're not giving me good odds.
Right. Everybody wants the director to know. They actually want the director to succeed, but they're ready to look at it and sort of say, you know, I don't think he or she is. They don't have it. They don't understand
right.
the scene today, or whatever. And then you can start to lose that support system. But I mean, there's nothing more exciting than an actor coming up with a legitimate problem, and suddenly you're in the middle of it, and it's so exciting to see the solution, you know, emerge. I mean, I'm so thrilled. That's why I love actors who, you know, want to contribute.
Right.
Like Felicity Jones was in Inferno. And of course, Rogue One after that, and before that, Theory of Everything, where she was nominated for. Very bright, talented woman. But, you know, in 30 years old. And she's working with Tom Hanks and I. And you could see that she was a little reluctant to engage in this kind of conversation.
Because of the legendary status, you and Tom are there.
And the fact that Tom and I would inevitably slip into war stories, and then we'd have to apologize for her and say, this must be boring the hell out of you, Felicity, but when we were back doing Splash underwater, which we kind of couldn't help ourselves, but she said, no, I'm learning as much from that as anything and keep going. But I loved seeing her get her footing, and I loved what she did with that character. And a lot of it was her taking ownership and my beginning to understand what she had to contribute and knowing how to support her in that. And that's thrilling for me. So I'm always looking for that, whether it's, again, the cinematographers, editors, composers, but writers. I love that collaboration. You know, it's very exciting for me always with the cast.
Well, I would say the first film that really got me was Parenthood.
Oh,
and
thank you.
You know, I saw it when it came out in theaters, and then for this, I watched it again, and it's funny that it connected with me again, but in a whole different way. I mean, I have kids, and they're the age of some of those kids in there, and I didn't have kids the first time I watched it, but it connected with me both times, and I wanted to talk about that as an example of a film, because I think that film probably changed your scope as a director of what could be done with cinema. I mean, was that film...
Definitely.
Do you feel close to that film?
I feel very close to that film. It's probably my most personal film because it was made at a time where I could have been the Steve Martin character. And almost all of us involved, Brian Grazer, myself, Lowell Ganz, Bob Lou Mandel, we were all kind of living that, you know. And so for all of us, it was very personal, and it was a very important stepping stone. But it was a great experience, the sort of the serio-comic combination, the different ways in which it reached different audience members.
Right.
It's the first time that I was really, aware of that possibility. And I love stories that create empathy. Now, notice I didn't necessarily say sympathy, although you certainly want the audience to feel sympathy for some characters. I'd like them to feel empathy for almost all of them. And that is a goal for me, is to sort of put the audience in the circumstance as best I can, whatever the genre, and try to create some suspense around that, whether it's comedy, fantasy, or thriller, you know, or adventure story.
Yeah.
And that's that process of sharing with the audience ideas that feel very, very relatable. And it's a different kind of, you know, it's not the purest kind of escapism. It's more
no.
about connecting. But it can still be fun, and it can still be exciting and thrilling, but there is that sort of emotional tether.
Did that film feel like a risk to you at the time?
Well, they all feel like risks. In fact, when the ones that I felt sure about commercially have almost always been somewhat disappointing.
Really?
And the ones that I was unsure of tended to do better. Like Apollo 13, I had no idea that was going to be a commercial movie. I didn't think Cocoon would be commercial. So, no, I wasn't convinced that Parenthood was going to be commercial. We made it modestly. You know, I always have a way of, I like to reduce, be a little reductive. It's almost like a way of taking a little bit of the pressure off. Like with Cocoon, I used to call it Close Encounters on Golden Pond. Just as a way of sort of saying, come on, you're not reinventing the wheel here, you know. But and Parenthood, I used, my goal was to sort of say, the greatest sitcom ever told.
You were managing your expectations.
Yes, right.
I wonder if that's a movie where you discovered that to discover an essential truth about something, you can go as specific as you want and personal as you want, and it will still resonate. But if you don't do the work to discover that essential truth, you can't make a connection. I mean, was there a discovery there for you on
Definitely.
That?
Definitely. It was the first movie, even though it was fiction, that was built on bedrock of authenticity. I did Parenthood, which was sort of inspired by me and the inner creative circle, us, some of the things that we'd felt and emotions that were very real to me and that I had experience with. And then I did a movie called The Paper, which was about journalism,
right.
A subject I loved. So I was beginning to move into this area of building on authenticity first and foremost, and then letting the fiction grow out of that, which, you're right, began with Parenthood. Then came Apollo 13, and I'd always been afraid to deal with a true story because I thought it was going to be artistically, creatively limiting. But the story was so compelling, and it was such a great cinematic opportunity.
Yeah.
And I had this probably the most exciting creative experience ever. Parenthood was very personal. I loved making some movies. Lots of them. I've loved it, but I think there was something about Apollo 13, the story we were telling, which was little known, using movie magic to try to, in a very authentic way, let people understand what those space pioneers really did,
right?
You know, and tell this story that was kind of bittersweet because it wasn't about a triumph. It was about survival and a rescue.
What did that open up for you? Because it's just like this new project that you have, the Einstein film Genius on National Geographic Channel. It's taking something that people think they know, and it's finding out there's all these tributaries of stories that haven't been mined.
I'll tell you, Apollo 13 opened up that possibility because I not only enjoyed it, but I was also really blown away by the way audiences responded to real events and the details in real events. They had much more patience for the specifics and the details than they would a movie that's a thriller or a genre movie. But here was the big epiphany. Audiences were so fascinated by the details of it. Even if they didn't quite understand those acronyms and all of it, you could tell it became part of the entertainment value of the story. But when we were doing test screenings for the movie, there's no publicity. You just drop the movie in an audience.
Sure.
And they know it's a test audience. They don't even know what they're going to see. And so this audience loved the movie. Even though our visual effects weren't finished, it was just so thrilling. The test scores were, spectacular. In fact, there was only one out of 400 that gave it a poor. I mean, that's great when you... But, of course, as a director, even though at that point I had Final Cut already and I didn't have to worry about that guy's card, I needed to find the poor. And it was a guy. It was a young guy, age 21. And he just did not like it at all. Just poor, wouldn't recommend it, just big, terse bold pencil strokes, just dismissive as hell. Finally, I flipped over the card and I couldn't figure out what was bothering this guy. And I said, please comment on the ending. He said, terrible. More Hollywood bullshit. They would never survive. So, of course, he didn't know it was based on a true story, and he thought it was hokum.
Exactly. You know, I mean...
So I thought, that's another reason you make true stories, because you take really extraordinary moments where, outcomes defy expectation, behaviors defy expectation and logic sometimes,
yeah.
But they happened. And that's what you get to work with. So suddenly your storytelling can be so much more extreme, and within that is the freedom, because now you want to apply cinema to that and express to an audience, you know, it's not a documentary, you still have to make these creative, you know, choices to try to express to an audience again what it might have felt like to be there. And that's a really thrilling job for me, and since then I've done, you know, 6 movies based on real events, and now this piece about Einstein for National Geographic, which was a real joy. And I don't think I would have tackled this subject, either as a director or an executive producer, had I not had the experience of A Beautiful Mind and some of the other, stories, movies based on real events. Because, I mean, you know, we're dealing with Einstein here. The bar is high.
Well, it's funny. You know, you've said in many conversations that you call yourself a non-intellectual. And I think that taking a story that's that complex and figuring out how to cinematically tell it in a way that audiences not only will feel engaged and feel like they can keep up, but also that they can find the humanity in someone that before they've held on a pedestal, I think that's an intellectual pursuit. Well, I wonder if you call yourself that. I wonder if that's sort of that imposter syndrome that comes from a kid who didn't go to an Ivy League school.
Well, I don't know. I certainly am, you know, I'm not the best educated person, but the filmmaking process has provided me a lot of opportunities to educate myself and interact with really brilliant people.
Yeah.
Learn that I could keep up. I could more than keep up. I could lead. And so that's meant, a great deal to me over the years. I wouldn't have tackled this story if I didn't feel I could, you know, I could deliver something exciting, entertaining, surprising. So even though I had looked at outlines in the past based on Einstein's life for, you know, presentations for movies, even a screenplay many years ago, I think, and I never felt like it fit the movie narrative. But the idea that we could do it, you know, and do it for this network, National Geographic, and tell it in 10 hours, I felt like we had a chance as storytellers to do this man, you know, justice. And deal with him, warts and all, because he was a complicated guy. And nobody is immune from those human foibles or those moments of, you know, of character deficiency or really difficult choices. And Einstein, who was not an introvert, you know, he loved life. He loved women. I mean, he was kind of he was a ladies' man. Who would have known that?
Gosh, a TV series like that, even a limited series, is such a different art form than a film, because in a film, 90% of your work is figuring out how to get your story into
a compressed format.
And a format that's pretty defined.
Yes, and will flow and hold an audience's attention in a single viewing. Right. But the way the business is evolving, it now makes sense to work in a lot of different formats, whether it's short form, whether it's, you know, OTT work, whether it's documentary, there's no better place to make this story of Einstein than for National Geographic. Yeah. And I'm not just saying it because they bought it. It sends a signal to the audience, you know. And I think because there are so many shows, there are so many options out there for all of us,
yeah,
that anything that helps define and build the case for why this particular project is worth sampling, is worth exploring, helps, because we as storytellers, well, what? We want our stories to be seen and heard.
Well, I look at a film like Rush that you did, that I just love, and I feel like what a complex, giant story that is. Even in script form, you have to be able to, number one, have a very specific point of view, and number two, crack the code of what the story is about. And I wonder if there was a time when that all became more transparent to you. You figured out how to use the medium rather than having the medium be a mystery to you.
Well, I feel that I'm growing all the time. And again, you talk about a movie like Rush. I couldn't have made it even 10 years before. It was a labor of love project. Peter Morgan's script was remarkable, based on real events, so there was a tremendous amount of research. But I think he understood the character dynamics and what could be entertaining about that and revealing and thematically rich. But I also felt like there was this, that you had to understand on a visceral level what it was to get into those cars and race.
You were so good at understanding human emotions that you take that part of it for granted in a way. Like when you describe your big accomplishment, it's with the visceral thrill of getting in those cars. But I think watching that film, I learn about how men feel misunderstood, how they deal with ego. You know, an audience for that film, I think your allegiance can change from one character to the next. And I think one of the great accomplishments in that film is that it gets inside what it is to be a man that needs accomplishment to feel worthy.
One of the things that you said that I also, I'm really glad you felt, and it was something that I really wanted, was a lot of people were saying, who's the hero, who's the villain? And again, I get back to that idea of empathy and sympathy. And I think it was important to me that your allegiance could shift.
Yeah. Or,
you know, and, you know, that was challenging and very important to work with the actors. And again, you know, that's I love those kinds of challenges and helping work with actors to try to meet those challenges and then take that material to the editing room and find the most cohesive, most expressive performance.
I would think that at one point you would have to take ownership of the script entirely. You're going to have to narrow your point of view or define your point of view.
Yeah.
To make the movie thematically strong, whereas, because you could give that same script to 10 different directors, you'd have 10 different movies.
Yes, yeah, you do have to, and that's the high wire act. But you have to come to terms with yourself. You know, if you're going to make a lot of films and a lot of television shows, and this is my way of life.
Yeah.
You know, some are going to turn out better than others, and the ones that disappoint you they're gut wrenching, each and every one, because you know you go into every project hoping it's going to be something, you know, an all-time great. But I was talking to a friend of mine who's, a Wall Street guy, and he's always been a trader, and he's in the bond trading business. And he said when he recruits young talent, he likes, you know, they have to understand math, but he loves to get men and women who are athletes, highly competitive athletes. And I said, oh, because it's, you're trying to win, right? It's kind of a zero-sum thing. He said, no, they know how to lose.
Ah.
They know how to lose and get back up and go hard. And nobody reaches that caliber of athletic achievement without losing a hell of a lot more than they ever win. And they learn how to cope with that. And I think if we're doing this kind of work, you know, you want to make it your life's work, you sort of have to have that mental toughness, or at least that understanding.
What I hear you saying is that you had to come to terms with the fact that there's going to be some failures along the way, and that shouldn't determine the choice for the next film. Is that true?
Yes, and I had a couple of early observations about that. One was I acted in a television show with Henry Fonda, which was not a good show. It was called The Smith Family. It was in between The Andy Griffith Show and Happy Days, and it lasted a year and a half. And he knew that I wanted to be a film student. I was still in high school then, but I was making Super 8 movies and letting him read little scripts and short stories and things like that. And he said, well, you clearly love all of this, and I think you should really pursue being a director, because if you love that medium, it's a director's medium. If you want to act and that's what you love, movies are great, television's fine, but you got to be on stage also. And he said, but either way you go, he said, you got to risk your career every so often. You've got to feel like you're challenging yourself and not repeating yourself. And, you know, it was very interesting for him. When I realized, because Brian Grazer and I were teaming up for Imagine Entertainment and it was working and Splash was a success and I could see I was going to get to make other, other movies and have a career, the only rule I gave myself was that I loved the medium and I wanted to explore it. I didn't want to be a brand unless that brand was just somehow quality, which is a very, you know, pretty vague. But I said, I'm not going to do what I've done on these television series and have a life where I'm basically telling the same story over and over again because we know people like it. I'm going to insist upon, challenging myself. And I reached a point, by the time Apollo 13 came around, where the creative community, studios, audiences, came to expect that variety from me.
Right.
And that was unbelievably liberating. And I began to feel the confidence so that now I don't choose a movie because I haven't worked in that genre before. Now I choose a story with themes that I like and believe in or a situation I think audiences are going to particularly enjoy and engage with. And I have the experience now to apply the appropriate genre to maximize that set of ideas and those characters. And that's really liberating.
But once you have a few hits, whether they're luck or not, I would think that's when the real fear comes in, because now you have to sustain something.
Well, now there's something to lose.
Right,
and,
right.
And I was able to work my way through that fear. And it was also, it was great to have had the experience I had as a kid, and I was around a lot of people who were high achievers, and I understood that they weren't always confident. I could see it even as a kid.
Because you were around all these adult directors and
stars, and I saw how much Andy Griffith put of himself into every one of those episodes. That looks like an aw shucks, easygoing, show to put on. Andy struggled. There were, if an episode wasn't good, he felt it to the very end. He put his stamp on that show.
You've talked about your own limitations as an actor. Mm. Like, you've said yourself that you feel like you have limited range as an actor, and you've said that you knew you were never going to be an artist
as
an actor.
Yes. I was right. I was right about that. I had a lot more creative potential as a director than I had as an actor. I don't quite have an actor's mentality. Yeah, I became an actor as a child, but I don't have a performer's mentality. And some people, Russell Crowe, De Niro, Cate Blanchett, Hanks can embody something, and they use their whole system, so that their body becomes an instrument. They can do that kind of work. If I was well cast, I could be very effective, but I could just see it. I could see it, and I can see it to this day. So I'd rather take the artist, create the environment where he or she can, max out, flourish.
When you see that kind of actor at work, mm-hmm. is that still a mystery to you, even though you've done it?
Well, I do think there's this kind of an X factor there. I do think that people have a gift. I'm not sure that can be learned. I think it can be encouraged. I think it can be brought out. But I think some people, it has to do with, their minds, their physicality, and their ability to somehow access it, and in remarkable ways. And so I'm in awe of that. And what I try to do is help, or guide, if they're some given their personalities, are they interfering with their own process in some way? Can I help with that? But mostly, can I understand where what they have to offer and this story can intersect, and can I create the opportunity to get those moments of intersection, photographed in the right way? Can I do that? And that's my job.
It's a mystery to me is how some actors can look down for a minute and look back, and there's 3 pages of exposition in that glance, and it's not a trick.
Yeah.
They are transferring information to the audience, and I would bet that they don't know how they do, or they couldn't put words to it. Is that valid to you?
Absolutely. Great actors achieve that. I'll tell 2 quick stories about it. One, I wasn't directing, but I was watching my friend Tom Hanks evolve as an actor, and I saw a moment in Forrest Gump when the bus is driving away and he's left alone. And I always thought Tom was incredibly talented, incredibly glib, very funny, full of emotion, but I thought he was most alive when he was talking. And I saw that moment and the way he filled it. And I remember thinking, now he's a great screen actor. And then when I began directing him on Apollo 13 a year or so later, I saw it for myself and I could see it live. And I would sometimes just have a camera, a B camera, come over and not even tell Tom. And because it wasn't about calibrating for a close-up or anything like that. He was just feeling these scenes in these particular ways. And I would have a camera just find him and capture these things. It's powerful, you know? And you mentioned Parenthood. I had a great experience directing fantastic character actor, legendary stage actor, Jason Robards Jr.
Oh, yeah.
But I cast him in this role. He's playing the paternal, you know, the grandfather character. And he's got this powerful scene with Tom Hulse, where Tom Hulse is the younger son who's disappointing his father, basically. He's a bit of a near-to-well.
It's the fear that every parent has.
Yeah, yeah.
That you get that kid.
and that he's just never going to quite grow up, you know, and turn the corner. And so we're doing this scene, and unfortunately, it's the first scene that Jason has to do given the way we're scheduling it. So we're not getting to go in, you know, in story order, which is too bad. But we're playing out this scene, and I have the camera favoring Jason now. It's kind of a closer shot. We can really read the details of what he's feeling. And I didn't think he was registering enough. I didn't feel like he was, you know, I didn't feel that pain. He seemed to be sort of withholding his emotions and just, you know, and he was chilly. But I didn't feel the hurt, you know. And I thought we needed to get a take where we tried to achieve that. And so at this point, I was 34 years old. And I went up to Jason, and I'm talking
Who's
to
what, him. Who's, what, 65 at the time?
Yeah, 65 or 70, you know, and had won multiple Tonys and Oscars and so forth. And I'm talking to him about the moment, and I don't want to give him a line reading, for God's sakes, not Jason Robards Jr. So I'm kind of rambling along, trying to find the words to not offend, but to provoke, you know, something. And he reached over and touched my hand, and he said, "Ron, do you want a sadder face?" And now I thought, okay, well, now the veteran is just fucking with the young director. And now, okay, so we'll do a take, and he'll make a big mug shot, you know, a muggy face or something, and then I'll come in and we'll calibrate from there, I suppose. And, you know, but okay, I said, well, maybe that's it. And let's just try it. And we rolled the cameras, and it's the take that's in the movie. It was the most honest, organic, truthful depiction of that moment I could have ever dreamed of. And for Jason Robards Jr. at age 65 or 70, all he needed was a word, sadder, and or two words, sadder face, and he could process that in a way that whether he was feeling it, I don't know what his emotional biosystem, I don't know what was going on, what his biochemistry was, but what I saw was entirely truthful and evoked everything that I was hoping for. So I, you know, that was a lesson learned, that actors can keep getting better. It is an art form, and it's high art, and it's awesome to see it on display.
In the end, what do you take away from that?
It's always an exploration. I've given directions and I've unhinged actors.
How do you walk that back?
Well, you almost can't. You try. But I mean, I try not to say too much until we've gotten a couple of takes. I mean, I kind of want to get the actor's organic version first, unless I'm seeing it in rehearsal and it's taking the scene in entirely the wrong direction, and then begin a little process of experimentation.
What happens when their baseline is so far off from your expectation?
I mean, I have replaced actors. Sometimes there's a disconnect. It hasn't happened more than a handful of times.
Right.
But If you made them a mistake in casting, you know that sometimes you have to rectify it in a really disappointing way. But if you're thorough about the casting process, it pretty much never happens. And I am thorough. As much as I really, really hate putting actors through that process of auditions and meetings and discussions and all that stuff, I hate it as an actor myself. I hate putting people I respect and a craft and an art form that I respect through that sort of dehumanizing process, but better that than, you know, than a mistake that you have to adjust, you know, when you're in production. But almost every project, I look at what we're doing and I see a minefield of dangerous directions that it could go, and I'm trying to avoid them as best I can. But I've also made enough films and television shows to see that sometimes it's not what you anticipated that winds up hurting your project. It's something you didn't anticipate. So again, live action production, unlike animation, is an inexact process. And like, yeah, you know, Robert Altman said, you know, the movie speaks for itself eventually. It kind of evolves into itself. And you can, as much as you want to apply your auteur, you know, controls to that, you have to also understand that they take on a life of their own. And I've seen it happen, and I've seen things elevate, and I've seen things ultimately disappoint. But when I'm midway through it, I'm just a total advocate, believer, and trying to make the moments great. And then you take it to the editing room, and that's where you begin to see whether the moments have added up in the way you hoped they would. And the most disappointing thing is when it miscommunicates, or it communicates as you'd planned, but somehow that is not speaking to the audience and reaching them in the way that you and your collaborators thought it would. It's the most honest mistake, because it's some sort of misjudgment that is really impossible to anticipate, or next to impossible to anticipate.
Yeah, I think that would be the hardest situation, is when the film works out exactly like you wanted it to, and then it doesn't
connect. And people fold their arms and say,
Right. I mean, do you
sort of... We all do it. I mean,
sure.
You know, I mean, when we watch something, it lands or it doesn't land.
Right.
And everybody, I can guarantee you, people busted their asses.
I think it's a miracle when something does land collectively.
Yeah.
Because certainly it lands to somebody. Everything lands for somebody.
Right, right.
But for something to land collectively seems like it's just... You couldn't take it personally, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is there too many factors out of your control, even though you're the director? Or are you someone who says, I take the responsibility, good or bad?
I do take the responsibility, good or bad.
You do? You don't chalk it up to sometimes?
Oh, well, I think there are... I mean, I can look myself in the mirror and say, well, I didn't see that one coming, and neither did, you know, some very important people,
right,
you know, in the process. Damn. But I don't ever think anything is anybody else's fault.
You don't?
No. I could say that I wasn't alone in being wrong, nor was I alone in being right. So I like the team. By the way, as much as I love to be the director, and I enjoy producing, I do. Like the collaboration and the team spirit.
Right. Are you hard on yourself when something doesn't work?
Yeah, of course. Because who else's job was it to get it right?
Have you ever gotten a critique that you really took to heart and learned from? Like, do you ever learn from that experience of, or have you ever had a film that you know, the experience was different for you than it was for the audience, or it was positive?
Oh yes, all of the above. Yes, sometimes a movie means a lot to you, a story means a lot to you, and you're just in that minority, you know. Because as you said, every story speaks to, you know, some portion of the audience.
Yeah.
If you're making broad mainstream entertainment, which is what I do and what I want to do, you've got to reach the majority.
That's a high bar to set.
And it's a high bar to set. And I've learned a lot over the years about kind of asking the right sort of questions to understand, where the project is going and what people might be anticipating. But it's a fascinating process, and I've gotten better and better at it, and a little bit less tough on myself. Whereas in the beginning, the editing room was where I was really just wanted to slip my wrists, because it was just like, who's directing this frickin' movie? Really? That's you didn't do another take? There's a great thing in the movie. All that jazz, where Bob Fosse directed it, and Roy Scheider's playing Bob Fosse, basically, doing right. Lenny, and he's in the editing room, and he's flipping out, and he's saying, God damn it, what asshole told the actor to do that? Me! I'm the asshole that told the actor to do it, play it that way. And it's like the most honest thing about directing, because sometimes directing does, you know, it does make you feel stupid.
Well, do you ever wonder what it is, like, how it is that you get so much smarter when you're on the editing couch and you're looking at it going, why couldn't I see that?
It's that, you know, you saw a portion of it, but you couldn't see it all together. It is a kind of mosaic, and you're piecing it together. But it's the question of all questions, and we're always trying to do better at it.
You know what I liken it to? I liken it to when you watch home movies of your kids a few years later. You know, when you're there with the camera,
yeah,
and you're watching it, you're missing everything. And then you go back a couple of years and you watch, and you go, or even 6 months, and you say, why didn't I see what my child was doing or trying to tell me? Or
that's a great analogy. And
like, why can't we see real life as it happens?
Yeah, damn.
You know, I caught a frame of Bryce in Parenthood.
Oh yeah. She appeared in, I think, in our final scene. And once in a while, she would show up in my movies as an extra. She was always interested.
Well, you know, it broke my heart because it's that scene where, and obviously this isn't a new idea that parenting is a roller coaster, but you earned that metaphor in that film by, you know, by taking us on a ride. And then what I felt when we got to that part in Parenthood was I felt a bit of relief because you got the sense that we're doing the best we can, yeah, and it's not really within our control. Parenting
is acceptance of ourselves.
And that's the best lesson about that movie, and the best lesson about being a parent is learning to accept our humanness and to see your daughter in that moment. I mean, it kind of brought it all together for me of being a parent, thinking about what you were going through. And
well, that whole idea was born on a plane flight. It was a 17-hour plane flight to Buenos Aires. We were going to do the movie with Michael Keaton and Getty Watanabe, Gung Ho, and we couldn't get into any automobile plant in the U.S. It was about a Japanese company taking over an American automobile plant. And so we had to go to Buenos Aires where they would let us use this one wing of this plant that was semi-shut down. And, Bryce was about 4 years old, and we had our twins, Jocelyn and Paige, were only about 7 months old. So Bryce was maybe 4 and a half. And she was going to sit next to me on this 17-hour flight. Now, we didn't ship ahead. We needed the diapers and the baby formula and all of the stuff that we needed with us. So you were only allowed 2 carry-on items. I had 24 carry-on items. So I got the crew, it was a commercial flight, to all carry on stuff for me. And I was going to, my job was to look after Bryce on the flight. And so they had this little vegetarian sushi dish. And I said, do you want to try sushi? There's no fish in it. It's just vegetarian. She said, okay. And she tried it. And within the first 40 minutes of the flight, she projectile vomited all over my shirt. And I had no change. So I was just like, oh, God. And the babies were crying. And I was helping Cheryl. And we were just walking them and driving the crew crazy. And we got landed. And we got all 24 pieces of luggage. And I was pulling luggage off the carousel, just sweating like a pig. You know, I was like, how old was I? 32, 33 years old. I was just like an old man, just suffering. And I just thought, nobody told me. Why wouldn't anybody tell me what this was like? I was feeling so sorry for myself. And I realized, oh, that's funny. Because if people told you, you know, none of us would do it.
Yeah.
And I just started laughing while I was on the carousel. A little bit like Steve Martin is laughing at the end when he realizes it's chaos, but it's my life and it's what I want. And that was in a weird way, the emotion that sort of hatched that idea was kind of the emotion on Steve Martin's face there at the end of the movie.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if it's because I grew up with you on my television or the stories you're able to tell or a combination of both, but it's just great to be able to hear you share these stories and connect with your films and know that there's not that great of a difference between the man and the work you're making. And I admire the work you do, and more than that, I just admire the way you've lived your life.
So, thank you.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. What a great opportunity to talk. I love your show.
Here
I am, the 100th episode, and I gotta say I'm a fan, you know, which is why I'm here.
I can't think of a better 100th guest, so
thank you
for doing this.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Our 100th show, in case you forgot. You know, we could not make this show without the hard work of a lot of talented people. Let's start with Nathan Shields, who has added trumpet player to his long list of duties here at the off-camera studios. Crawford Shippey, our producer and head of the Department of Adult Supervision. Michaela Galvin, our graphic designer, camera person, retoucher, and sugar supplier for the whole office. Laura Kemper, who holds the fort down and makes sure everything happens when it's supposed to happen, and that nothing happens that isn't supposed to happen. Amy Jones, who makes us all seem a little bit smarter through her fine writing and editing skills. And Justin Kennedy, who helps our guests be lint-free and fancy. Kara Johnson, who listens to every one of these conversations and transcribes them so we can read them. And Matt Davidson, who scours the perimeter of off-camera for trash and other unsightly items and make sure that all the bathrooms are working properly. And most of all, you, the listener, for sticking with us for 100 episodes. We really hope you'll be around for the next 100. And if you're new to the show, please take a moment, go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Off Camera. Also, check out our website, offcamera.com. We have a store. We sell magazines. The magazines are exclusive. We make one for every guest. And in an era where nothing is printed, Off Camera still has something for your coffee table. So check that out. And if you want to drop me a line, I'm sam@offcamera.com. On social media, we are Off Camera Show on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for going along this journey with us and for tuning into these conversations. I'll make you a deal. You keep listening and I'll keep making them. And as proof of that, we have another show coming next week, episode number 101. And there will be no trumpet for that, but you must join me next time when I sit down with actor, director, and producer Colin Hanks.
I would never have gotten into acting if it wasn't something that I thoroughly enjoyed and loved doing. There's no equation for it. Break it down like this. In math, you go, okay, it's a summation. This and that, and the answer is always going to be that every time. And with acting, it's never going to be that every time. Never.
You likely know him from films like his breakout teen indie, Orange County, and his excellent work on TV series like Fargo, Mad Men, and Life in Pieces. But the work that truly changed his career happened behind the camera with two fascinating documentaries, one of which his friends begged him not to make. See you next time, off camera.